Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Ready?
I was born ready.
Welcome to the Advisory Opinions Podcast. This is David French with Sarah Isger. And before we dive into the guts of the podcast, I want to take just a second and plug thedispatch.com. We're in the middle of a 30-day free trial period. So you can sign up for free for 30 days to get all of the wonderful things that the Dispatch has to offer. A lot of you are what we call, and with nothing but affection, free listers. Meaning you've signed up to receive the free elements of our work. But if you can take an extra step and dip the toe in the water for 30 more days of freeness, you're not only going to get, for example, Sarah's Monday sweep, which you were already getting if you had subscribed to it, but you're also going to get her midweek mop-up. If you are a free lister, you're only getting one third of the things that I write, because I write twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays. If I'm diligent, Wednesdays and Fridays, if I'm procrastinating. So three times a week with the French Press newsletter. Jonah has a midweek epistle that is behind the paywall. We have a lot of stuff that is behind the paywall. But if you go to thedispatch.com/30days free, you can have 30 days free. And also, while I'm plugging Dispatch work, let me plug this podcast, specifically reviewing it. Please go review us on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Leave a comment. It helps us out a great deal, and we appreciate it. Now, Sarah, on to the main event. So this is a 3-part podcast. Part one, state of the race. Part two, a segment we're going to helpfully call Sarah's Friends List, which
ridiculous.
Is not ridiculous, as you'll see, but it is going to be Sarah's personal insights into all of her buddies on the new Donald Trump Supreme Court list. And then the last thing we're going to end with is a discussion of critical race theory. I wrote about it in my Sunday newsletter. It has kicked off quite the discussion. And so I thought, and this is actually in response to some questions that I got from folks asking us to address critical race theory, what it is and what its limitations are and uses are. On the podcast. So we got a lot of really meaty stuff to talk about. But first, so Sarah, you've got a newsletter, The Sweep, coming out really any minute now, probably will come out even as we record the podcast. And so give us a preview of what is in The Sweep. And also tell us, has anything changed in this here presidential race?
Know if things have changed, but we always get, you know, more information, and that can make it feel like it changed. So there's 3 buckets I want to talk about today.
Okay.
A money bucket, a polling bucket, and a field operation bucket. That's the one I want to spend the most time on. So let's just real quick on the money bucket, because this made huge headlines a few days ago. For July, so go back 2 months, the Trump campaign outraised the Biden campaign, not by a lot, but the Trump campaign raised $165 million and the Biden campaign raised $140 million. Those are both good hauls, not just respectable hauls. They're good hauls.
Right.
So we got the August numbers that the campaigns themselves released. We don't have the FEC reports yet. We should be getting those tomorrow or the next day. And so I think we'll probably want to dive in again on these numbers once I can actually look at the full report and see where all the money went. But we have the top line raise numbers. We do not have the cash on hand numbers, which frankly is the real number. But the raise numbers do tell you something, especially this time. So for the month of August, the Trump campaign raised $210 million. That's what you want to see. 165 in July, 210 in August. You want to see that number going up. It means their donor list is, you know, getting activated and churning out those dollars. The Biden campaign raised $150 million more than that.
Yeah.
That's wild. Now, again, yeah. I want to see how much the Biden campaign spent to raise that amount, because if you're spending 80 cents to raise a dollar, then yeah, that raise number tells you a lot about your ability to find new donors, that prospecting list that we've talked about before. But it doesn't actually tell you how much money you have to spend on the race, if that makes sense. So like those donors that you find that are, you know, $5 donors, they are more likely to vote now because they're invested in your campaign. It is a good thing to be able to raise that much money, even if you spent 80 cents on the dollar. But you'd still want to know that cash on hand number to let us know how much you're going to be able to spend for the rest of the campaign. But a couple of things to note about this before we get the cash on hand number. First of all, money starts having a diminishing value here, like now, especially right. with the early vote that we're expecting. North Carolina already voting. Let's see, Georgia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan all start voting this week, some in person, some absentee ballot. So the money's diminishing no matter what because the votes are already coming in. But even if that weren't true, even if we're talking about election day, the money starts diminishing because you can really no longer spend it on your field operation. If that's not already in place, it's not getting in place now. So
right.
the money at this point is going to TV, and or you spent money you didn't have knowing you'd get in money. Fair enough. So that's the money thing. David, any thoughts, feelings on money?
Yeah, you know, I you know, when I saw that gap, the first time I began to think, okay, does this, you know, because the operating presumption that I've had is that there's been all kinds of enthusiasm for Trump and not a lot of enthusiasm for Biden, but a lot of enthusiasm against Trump. And there are a lot of different ways to measure enthusiasm gaps. And, you know, especially if you're talking, I'd love to see like the breakdown in small dollar donors, large donors, et cetera. And if you've got a lot of small dollar donors coming in to create that big of a gap, I'm wondering if that is something that is sort of a rough and imperfect, but somewhat of a measure of whether it's anti-Trump more than pro-Biden. Is there a surge of enthusiasm for the Democratic ticket or oppose the Republican ticket as we get closer? And that was one interesting question I had. I'm less convinced that money differences matter a great deal. The way I've kind of thought about this and recent years is both major parties raise enough money
yes.
to run sophisticated campaigns. And if one raises, you know, 25% or 30% more over the course of a campaign, they're still raising enough money to run their campaigns. So I'm not so sure, you know, how many more sweepers, to use the curling analogy, can Biden hire now? Enough to make a difference? I don't know.
That's true, although we've seen some odd stuff with the Trump campaign going off TV in a bunch of battleground states.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you'd still have to believe that TV makes a big difference. Probably you'd need to believe that it has some persuasion value, which we don't think it does. We think it has turnout value. So even so, like, it's odd to me that they're still going off TV. I thought that was just going to be a mid-convention tweak. And I agreed with them strategically that going off TV during the convention to do those tweaks made perfect sense because you're already on TV because of the convention. But they're still off TV in a bunch of these states. So really interested in the cash on hand numbers. I think it will be small dollar donors, a lot of them, because in theory, the Biden campaign should have been able to sweep up all of their big ticket donors to max out the second he got that nomination solidified. So that really should have been happening in June and July. But it's possible that with Harris added to the ticket, that they went back to the non-maxed out, still large donors and had them max out. So we could see some larger donors finally maxing out. And so it might not be as big a small dollar haul as we think looking at the number, but we'll see.
Yeah. So can I ask you a completely useless anecdotal question?
I love useless questions.
Okay. So do you live in a Biden precinct? What will be a Biden precinct?
I believe that I do.
Okay. What's your yard sign situation?
Oh my God. So I cover that in the sweep today. Can I just read you my favorite headline of all time? Maybe of literally all political time?
Yes, please.
Sorry, campaign managers. Lawn signs are only 98.3% useless.
I love
Hat
it.
Hat tip, Philip Bump at the Washington Post. Big fan of his, but yeah. You know, so I live in sort of suburban DC, and there are not a lot of yard signs yet, but I haven't seen a single Trump yard sign. I've maybe seen four Biden yard signs, not in an aggressive way, like in a very tactful suburban way.
Right.
But in fairness, David, I am not out a lot. I'm still pretty quarantined in my house.
Gotcha. Okay. I was just, you know, it's so funny because you, if you're not on Twitter, you don't know about sort of the kind of the anecdotal yard sign wars.
Oh my God.
Which is really funny, but it's sort of like, hey, watch out, y'all. Don't pay attention to the polls. I was out in sort of rural Pennsylvania and I saw nothing but Trump yard signs.
And this is why candidates, by the way, are obsessed with yard signs. Campaign managers hate them. They're a logistical nightmare. You need volunteers to build them because they actually just come from the company as like the wire frame, the three-sided wire frame, and then the sleeve that you have to put over it. So you need volunteer hours to build them. And then you've got to deliver them or have your people who want them come pick them up. They're a nightmare and just a total waste of time. And every political science, like the major political science experiment we have on these shows that you as a supporter putting a yard sign in your lawn, zero effect. Actually zero. Now, there is some evidence that you could have a 1.7% effect, which is not nothing actually. That's, you know, especially in a down ballot race and a tight race, that could be meaningful if you randomly distribute them through a precinct.
Interesting.
Which no one does. Because my thoughts on that could make a difference.
I'm already wondering if we're taking our podcast off the rails. Maybe we're only 98.3% off the rails in talking about yard signs. But my assumption has always been you have a lot of these down ballot races, say for like county clerk or alderman third district or something like that. And you may not be all that familiar and you might be swayed by that's a name I recognize from being all over the neighborhood.
So that's the 1.7% effect. It's mostly name ID. And yet yard signs have quadrupled between 1984 and 2012. It just turns out that almost anything else you can do is more meaningful than a yard sign, except for one thing, which is your candidate's headspace. Yard signs are just up in your candidate's headspace. So what campaign managers will do, and I did not include this in the sweep, but what campaign managers will do, because I didn't want it in writing that I had done it, but I have, is you know the route
right
from picking up your candidate or the airport or whatever else to the place you're going with your candidate. And you will actually, I swear to you, spend the volunteer hours to put yard signs on the route that you're going to drive just so your candidate sees them and they're in a good headspace when they arrive at that town hall, rally, donor event, whatever it is.
They're thinking, look at that spontaneous groundswell of grassroots support. The one thing that I do think is interesting about sort of the yard sign phenomenon is this concept known as, I think, did Jonah coin the term SMAGA, secret MAGA?
He coined it for me, whether it existed before Jonah, but I definitely got it from him.
Yeah, the whole SMAGA concept that there's a huge number of people are not proud of being Trump supporters who are going to come to the polls for Trump. And when you live in a red district, like that's just not a thing. Like it's so not a thing. I mean, one thing that you can say about like particularly the more enthusiastic Trump supporters is they are loud and proud. It's not a yard sign. It's a yard sign and a flag. Or it's a yard sign and a flag hanging outside the, on the typical, kind of flagpole on your front porch. And then
the barns were pretty cool. Remember the barns from 2016? They were painting the side of their barns. And I was like, that's actually awesome. That looks
good. Oh, yeah. You see Trump barns. But it's like sign, flag, and then another flag in like an upstairs bedroom window. I mean, there ain't no SMAGA in Middle Tennessee. Now, there might be SMAGA in Brooklyn. Where it doesn't matter. And I think there's like secret Biden where I am, but it doesn't matter.
That's right.
I tend to think the secret phenomenon are in those jurisdictions where the reason why you're secret is because you're in an overwhelming minority.
Yes.
Which
is true for anything. Like, it's just sort of intuitive.
Yeah.
So, speaking of surprising, like a Brooklyn Trump voter, we have three polls in the past week from Florida. And all three polls show Donald Trump winning the Hispanic vote.
Mm-hmm.
That is surprising. So Trump lost Miami-Dade County the Hispanic vote in Miami-Dade County by 30 points in 2016. That's about right. He is now leading Biden 47-46%. So look, that's within the margin, but who cares? The point is he's made up a 30-point deficit in 4 years in Miami-Dade County among Hispanic voters. This could be a big deal in Florida, especially as we've seen a 30-point swing, give or take. It's probably less than that among seniors the other direction. You could just have a total like reshuffling. I'm just imagining sort of the Etch-a-Sketch, like shake the Etch-a-Sketch in Florida, where the end result may actually look pretty similar. Florida being a swing state that's relatively close, maybe even leans a little red, but for totally different reasons. And if that's the case, and Trump makes this massive ground up with Hispanic voters, and not just Cubans, by the way, that cannot account for these Miami-Dade numbers. If that's the case, the future of the Republican Party conversation that everyone is having, if Trump loses in the future of the party, or if he wins in the future of the Republican Party, that's going to be a really different conversation if he just made up 30 points with Hispanic voters, given everything. It will tell us so much more about identity politics on the left and immigration wars and where all of that's going to sort out. That could be a really big deal. So keeping my eye on that, it could be an outlier, but three poll outlier,
Seems like there's enough polling to say the senior vote for Trump is sliding hard in Florida, but the Hispanic vote is surging. And the interesting thing about that is, I'm sure, anyone who follows politics closely is really familiar with this sort of demography as destiny argument. The emerging Democratic majority, the coalition of the ascendant. And that has always depended on the Hispanic vote being overwhelmingly Democratic. That analysis has always depended on that. And I've even seen smart people on the left say, why are you assuming that? Why are you assuming? Because it's not as if, say, the Hispanic vote in California, Hispanic vote in Texas, Hispanic vote in Florida, those are three big states where it can, there's enough voters for it to really, really matter. That's not all the same culture. It's not all the same.
No, in fact, we have Hispanic numbers from Arizona, and he's down 30 points with Hispanic voters in Arizona. So, like, that number has stayed largely the same, where Florida has shifted.
And a lot of folks I know kind of don't like this notion that you say if somebody is Cuban American or Mexican American or Colombian American or from Honduras or from, as far as their family ancestry, that they're all the same.
Right. Like,
they find that really reductive.
It is reductive.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why remember George W. Bush got well north of 40% of the Hispanic vote in 2004.
We also know that someone who moved to the country and became a citizen 10 years ago looks really different as a voter than their kid and then their kid, all of whom will be counted as quote unquote Hispanic voters. But it's not just that you know, one's from Venezuela and one's from Mexico, you know, first generation and third generation look wildly different as voters for obvious reasons. I mean, my grandmother is, you know, was first generation. So my mother was the first born here. And so, you know, while I identify somewhat, you know, as an immigrant family, like I don't have an accent. My grandmother has passed. So like she was part of my life with an accent for a long time, but it is so different as a second generation American.
So do you want to hear something wild, Sarah?
Yeah.
Okay. So I found this out while I was researching for my book and researching how deep amongst some voters, not all, but some voters, how deep our polarization runs and how deep our political identity runs. And it is this: for not a majority, but for a measurable and significant number of voters, a person with the identical ethnic makeup will identify as white or Hispanic, depending on their political affiliation. And so a person with the identical ethnic makeup will say they're white if they're Republican and Hispanic if they're Democrat. Now,
that's interesting because I know a Colombian immigrant Trump voter, and you're right, he identifies as white.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Also, people with identical religious beliefs will identify as different. Well, a Democrat with identical religious beliefs to a conservative evangelical or Republican evangelical will not identify as evangelical. In other words, that is become seen as such a marker of a political tribe that they will reject it, even if they have the identical theology as their Republican counterpart.
Well,
yeah.
On to my last section. Are you familiar with the Britney song, You Better Work, B?
Well, I don't know if my Britney library is that up to date. So, You Better Work, B.
Yeah, it's actually a great song because it's so true. You want a hot body, you want a Bugatti, you want a Maserati, you better work, B. You want a Lamborghini, sipping martinis, look hot in a bikini, you better work, B. I mean, that's just true, David.
I mean, you know, timeless wisdom, really.
That's right. That's right. So that is the name of the section in the sweep this week that I want to talk about, which is if you have a candidate that you feel strongly about and you want to help that candidate, what are the things that actually make a difference and that you should go do? We already talked about yard signs and my red hot hatred. And I talk about phone banking. I talk about social media, but we had some headlines this week. And what'll be really fascinating after the election and what you and I are definitely going to be talking about in, you know, late November, December, when we get some of the stats back, the Trump campaign put out a press release that they have knocked on their 100th million door and phone bank. They were including phone banking as well. But that's actually just a ton of doors that they're hitting in the pandemic. The Biden campaign has knocked on 0 doors. So for the first time, we're actually going to have the real experiment of does door knocking make a difference? Now, the Obama campaign in 2008 and 12, it was like a big deal that that's how they won the race.
Mm-hmm.
But we're about to find out whether that was really true. And what we have from social science experiments so far is that, yes, it can make a difference. It can get you about 40, like if you knock on 5,000 doors, and we're assuming a pretty high response rate, which makes sense in a pandemic that we'd actually get a high response rate because a lot more people are at home these days. So generally a high response rate of 5,000 doors would be about 1,000 people answering. That will generate around 40 new voters. And again, not persuading Biden voters to switch to Trump. We're talking about Trump-friendly people who were not going to vote. So it creates 40 new voters. So, and it costs around $33 a vote. Now, these are volunteers knocking on doors, but it takes a lot of staff time to put together the micro-targeting list of which doors to knock on, the maps for the voters, coordinating the volunteers, yada, yada. So about $33 a vote. This will be a big deal either way. It's a big deal if it works. It'll be a really big deal if it doesn't work and that's just the end of door knocking, because that'll really change what field operations look like.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's this new thing that has not been tried and is, as far as I know, not really being tried this cycle, called deep canvassing. And that's where, instead of going and having a script that you read off of, you ask them questions and probe their interests and everything else. The problem with that and why it's not being done is it's incredibly hard to train volunteers to sort of do empathetic listening, which, if you know, you're into books on psychology, is definitely a way to actually persuade people.
Uh-huh.
So that's not happening. But if door knocking, it turns out, is pointless, I think you could see more of that. Because in 2012, the really interesting study that nobody paid a lot of attention to was that, yes, door knocking made some difference, they think, in 2012 for Obama. But it actually made, remember how we were talking about how the average of 95 and 5 is the same as, you know, 45 and 55 or whatever? It looks like the Obama campaign was doing a little bit more good than harm, but they were actually also doing quite a bit of harm in their door knocking, because the people who volunteer to door knock do not look, and I mean look ideologically, demographically, age, they don't look like the people whose doors they need to knock on and persuade to go vote. In 2012, they were much whiter, much younger, and much more extreme ideologically. So even though you would give them a script, when you're phone banking, you're sitting in the campaign office often. And so the volunteer coordinator can hear if you go off script and are like being crazy. But if you're just out on your own, knocking on doors, you can sit there and talk about how, you know, abortion on demand is the most important thing and we need to shut down all the coal industry and move to the fully new Green Deal and capitalism is terrible and why do we even have it anymore? And the voter who you knocked on is like, whoa.
Yeah, come again.
So that not just can happen, it absolutely does happen with door knocking. So we'll see whether the Trump campaign has any sort of secret recipe that they'll share afterwards, whether it was helpful and hurtful, or whether it just made no difference at all.
Can I express a hint of skepticism at those numbers? Because 100 million is a lot.
They're self-reported. Yep.
Yeah, they're self-reported. And there was a really interesting... So Olivia Nuzzi?
Yeah.
She wrote a really interesting story in New York Magazine where she wanted to see the ground game. So she did this sort of deep reporting on the state of the race and the state of the campaign operation itself. And so this came out in mid-August, middle of last month. And she went around to some of these Pennsylvania events, and some of them weren't happening at all. Some of them were not attended at all. And some of them, the local campaign office did not even know they had been scheduled and advertised.
The other problem with the self-reported numbers is like, okay, you can knock on a door. Basically, it's quantity over quality. Even if it's all accurate, it doesn't mean anyone answered the door. It doesn't mean it was a real house in theory. It doesn't mean the phone number ever connected. Could have been a wrong number. They would count that still.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah. So I'm skeptical of those numbers, but I think there's still no doubt that the fundamental reality of what you're saying is correct, which is the Biden campaign is not emphasizing this. The Trump campaign is emphasizing this, and it's going to be interesting to see what kind of difference it makes. Before we move on, let me just sort of say, again, sort of my own sense of things, compared to 2016 is, there's both an extreme sense of agitation and simultaneously a sense of exhaustion, which sort of says, I'm highly agitated. Can we just vote and get this over? Whereas 2016 had much more sort of sense of, what is going to happen? This is interesting. This is fascinating. Everybody feels both more agitated and more fatalistic in the world that I'm inhabiting.
It'll be interesting to see how the debates affect that.
Yeah.
We're just over 2 weeks away from the first debate. I think there will be some more anticipation towards this debate, maybe even than 2016.
Oh, I think you're right about that, in part because the relentless messaging that Joe Biden isn't up for it. Yeah. So a lot of people are going to tune in just to see if he's up for it.
Definitely had a dream about the debate last night as I'm sitting here talking about this that I'm remembering. But anyway.
All right, shall we move on to...
Wait, by the way, David, do you know what the most effective thing to do? Door knocking, phone banking, yard signs, all of these things that you can do for a campaign to help your candidate?
Do tell.
It appears that the most effective thing you can do is call or text 20 of your closest friends, reminding them to vote.
Well, that makes sense.
Yep.
Yep.
Relational contact is by far the most effective per contact.
That makes a ton of sense. And it fits in with sort of a general reality that we have a large amount of influence over a small number of people and a very small amount of influence over a large number of people.
Yep. So when Facebook put up a banner that said like go vote or something that touched 60 million people. And from their own analytics, it made zero difference. It did not encourage a single person to go vote. But when they created the I voted sticker and individual people got to put the I voted sticker, that put a lot of social pressure on those people's, you know, 20 closest Facebook friends. And that increased turnout actually a real amount.
Now, interesting.
Let me be clear, David. Your persuasive Facebook post that says, not just go vote, I voted, you should go vote, but go vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump, and here's why, and blah, 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 and trying to switch people's votes, still not really any effect.
Surely you're saying
turnout,
about...
Yeah.
You're saying that about other people's Facebook posts, not my Facebook posts.
Oh, God. Yes, I feel like that's what everyone is hearing. But... definitely, if you want to help your candidate, make a list of, if it's 30 friends, 40 friends, however many of your close friends, and just say, don't forget to go vote. Now, obviously, this has much more an effect on down ballot races. In a midterm race, this can really, really change turnout. In a presidential race, turnout's actually very, very high among registered voters. But nevertheless, right. If you can find someone in your friend group who's a registered voter who is not going to go vote, it will have a huge chance of getting them to go vote, to hear from you that you voted and that you're sort of watching whether they vote.
I think in one person in my friend group, my local friend group, and he's probably a Joe Jorgensen voter. So, so if I well, remind him that Libertarian Party is going to get an extra vote.
In a local election, so, you know, not Senate, not even really congressional, but like a city council election, it can make a 13-point difference in turnout.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
That's a real number, Sarah.
That's the whole ball game. There is nothing else you could possibly do. No TV ads, no door knocking, no phone banking could make up the difference of a 13-point turnout.
Let's pause for a moment and thank our sponsor, Gabby Insurance. When you've had the same car insurance or homeowner's insurance for years, you get kind of trapped into paying your premiums and not thinking about it. That makes it really easy to overpay and not even realize it. I know exactly how that is. I had the same insurance for 10 years, finally decided to check on it and realized I was overpaying by about 40%. So stop overpaying for car and homeowners insurance. See about getting a lower rate for the exact same coverage you already have, thanks to Gabby. Gabby takes the pain out of shopping for insurance by giving you an apples to apples comparison of your current coverage with 40 of the top insurance providers like Progressive, Nationwide, and Travelers. Just link your current insurance account, and in just minutes, you'll be able to see the quotes for the exact same coverage you currently have. Gabby customers save $825 per year on average. If they can't find you savings like they have for so many others, they'll let you know so you can relax knowing you have the best rate out there. And they'll never sell your info, so no annoying spam or robocalls. It's totally free to check your rate, and there's no obligation. Take a few minutes right now and stop overpaying on your car and home insurance. Go to Gabby.com/advisory. That's GABI.com/advisory. Gabby.com/advisory. All right. Well, speaking of personal friend groups, this is a great segue. Okay. So Donald Trump announced his new additions to his Supreme Court list. And readers, so, I mean, listener, readers, you're not reading this. Listeners, what's the over-under on the number of people who have been in, that Sarah has had dinner with? The over-under on that. So, okay, that you've let's not make it exclusive.
I'm not counting. I'm not doing this.
You're not doing this? Just had a meal or a cup of coffee with?
That's embarrassing. No, I'm not counting.
No, it's not embarrassing. So how could it possibly be embarrassing? Because this is value added of this podcast. Because otherwise, it's just a people sort of saying, hey, you know, I read an opinion by this person once. And you can say, I know Ted Cruz likes Splenda and not Sweet and Low in his coffee. This is value.
That is always a big thing. If you know how someone takes their coffee, I mean, the hand that rocks the cradle, right?
Yeah.
It's the equivalent
that's
for
funny
candidates.
Story. Nancy and I, for those who don't know, Nancy and I barely dated before we got engaged and we're only engaged. We were dated 6 weeks before we got engaged. We're engaged for about 3 months before we got married. So we knew each other really for less than 5 months. And she was in our first year of marriage, we were in Manhattan and she was waiting for me at a restaurant and the waiter asked if I would like coffee. And not only did Nancy not know how I took my coffee, she didn't know if I drank coffee. And we were married. So...
So here's what I think is really interesting about the list. Aside from seeing many familiar faces, some good friends on the list, and that's all well and good. Two things. One, this list makes no difference whatsoever. The next opening will be filled by Amy Coney Barrett or Amul Thapar.
Hmm.
And they were already on, you know,
previous list. Yep.
I just don't think there's any question of that. But here's what this list does. First of all, it puts it just was an easy press release. Yeah. Every news organization had to cover it. It's a great headline for your supporters to see. It gets picked up on every cable news station. I didn't actually check if the nightly news covered it, but I wouldn't be shocked if it got, you know, 20 seconds on the nightly news potentially. So, I mean, what a brilliant thing to do. And I don't know why Trump keeps getting to do this, and yet the left, who has this opportunity to create Democratic Supreme Court voters, it was starting to bubble up after the Kavanaugh hearings, and they just didn't really do anything to capitalize on that or to educate their voters on what that would look like. So first of all, kudos to the Trump campaign. There is no downside to doing this. It, you know, and like as I said, I don't think a single person on this list will actually be on the Supreme Court, to be honest. But who cares? Second, there are some specific names on the list that are quite interesting and to me are like sort of specific dog whistle shout outs.
Yeah.
Kyle Duncan from the Fifth Circuit and Lawrence Van Dyke from the Ninth Circuit. Both are wonderful people, by the way. This is not a question of them being good judges or wonderful people. Lawrence, I've known Judge Van Dyke for quite a while. We went to law school together. But there are other judges on the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit who did not make this list, but are not as socially conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And Kyle Duncan in particular has been sort of, has a certain fan base within a very specific segment of the evangelical, social conservative, very high knowledge voters, and not even really voters, David, let's be real. It's people like you. Like Kyle Duncan is a meaningful name to the David Frenches of the world.
True.
And so for the administration to say, like, we know who Kyle Duncan is, we know he's meaningful to you, and we're going to put him on this list, even though we're not going to put him on the Supreme Court, because this tells you that we recognize quality or whatever, you know, it really says we're going to appoint more appellate judges in the frame of Kyle Duncan or Lawrence Van Dyke. So that was meaningful. You know, there were some names that were left off that were maybe a little surprising. Justin Walker not being on the list was very surprising to me. That's the new young judge who I also went to law school with, who is on the DC circuit, who had sort of been cause celeb there for a little bit. Not on the list. Surprising.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Well, I, you know, what I thought was you had here about as close as Trump could get, and even probably went about as far as he could possibly go. He didn't really put forth a bunch of people who met the new Josh Hawley test, except for maybe
there
Josh Hawley.
Those people,
right?
Yeah.
Right. Except for Josh Hawley, who's on the list. But he kind of went and said it was sort of like a wink, wink, nod, nod. If anybody is going to be as conservative as Josh Hawley wants, it's going to be these people. and then some of it sort of felt like fan service. Like, why do you include Cotton, Cruz, Hawley? Why include those people? It seems to me that's sort of like a reward. It's, hey, I'm giving you a presidential shout out. I'm sort of, in addition to saying you're good.
I think I might disagree for why they were included, because the David Frenches of the world know who Kyle Duncan is, mm-hmm. but a lot of people know who Cotton, Cruz and Hawley are. Who right. won't know who a single other name on this list. So for me, it was more like, hey, this isn't just for nerds. You can assume that the other people on this list are a lot like Cruz, Cotton and Hawley, and you know who they are.
Now, but the interesting thing is, Cruz, Cotton, and Hawley, I would not believe, if they were appointed on the Supreme Court, would have the same judicial philosophies.
No.
In fact, Hawley
all three are like quite different little strands, maybe from the same orchard, but they are different trees in that orchard.
And very much so. Very much so. So this was not it didn't strike me as, here is a list of people who have a particular judicial philosophy that I agree with as president. It seemed much more like, here is a list of people that fit in different categories of my base. And there's sort of somebody here for every category of the Trump base. There's the, you know, sort of the hardcore, what would be perceived as sort of the hardcore, always been a part of like the evangelical movement, the evangelical legal movement. There's also sort of the people that are like, well, they've been always been a part of the sort of originalist constitutionalist movement. And then there's the new sort of nationalist statists. So it's a very eclectic within the right list of people, which is a little bit different from the way it's been in the past, quite frankly.
There's also been some reporting that this is a Clarence Thomas list. A lot of former Thomas clerks make the list, and that this was to, you know, sort of a shout out to Clarence Thomas. I think another way to read that, though, is in fact, the way Clarence Thomas picks clerks mm-hmm. makes them more likely to appear on a list like this. He is less interested in law school pedigree, law review stuff, and far more interested in your judicial ideology.
Yeah.
And so, as you just said, this is a list that's far more ideological in that sense. And so, yes, there's going to tend to be more Thomas clerks on this list. There is one other theory, though, that is if you needed to add a single person to the list, you'd have to still include 20 people on the rest of the list in order to add that person, because otherwise you'd be signaling maybe a little too much. Like, you're not yep. saying you're definitely picking them. You just need to make sure to add them because you hadn't added them before. If that's what this list was, I'm looking at Barbara Lagoa out of the 11th Circuit, a really interesting judge down there, conservative, Hispanic woman, young, checks a lot of boxes. And if I were to pick someone who comes in number three after Amy Coney Barrett and Judge Thapar, mm-hmm. it's Judge Lagoa on the 11th Circuit.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting. Now, how many times have you had dinner with Judge Lagoa?
Zero. I was so excited for you to ask that. Ha! No, she's
okay.
She's a good friend of a friend. And so I've heard good things about her. She was flagged for me early on, but I have never met her. But I think she is a person to watch on this list. You know, there's other wonderful people on this list, but again, I think that's the one I would pick out as actually being on a real short list for the Supreme Court. Daniel Cameron, of course, is a rising star. He's the Attorney General of Kentucky, who spoke at the convention. Definitely a political rising star. Don't think he's actually on a Supreme Court shortlist, but for sure he's on a Senate shortlist and maybe even a cabinet shortlist.
Would he be on an appellate circuit court shortlist?
Honestly, if I'm advising Daniel Cameron, I would probably tell him not to do that.
I was wondering that.
I would, you know, it always depends on what your own ambitions are and your family. Being an appellate judge is a great position from which to have a family. But he has a lot of political potential, and I wouldn't hang up the spurs quite so quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're a rising political star, I mean, you're somebody who could be a senator from the state of Kentucky. If you're somebody once you become a senator, how many senators get one eye on the White House? And if you go into even a federal appellate court position, you're kind of where you are. I mean, like that's your life then. I mean, which is a great life. I mean, not many people ascend to that level, but let's say Trump wins a second term and Cameron's like 37 years old and he's appointed to appellate court position. There's no guarantee he's going to get the Supreme Court. That's at age 37. He's set there. That's where he is. And he might have, it sounds odd to say my ambitions do not end with a federal appellate in the federal appellate court, but some people,
it's quite a cloistered lifestyle.
Yeah.
And also, you know, if you, want to make a lot of money for your family and send your kids to college, but maybe don't want to have your wife work, you know, an appellate judgeship pays very well, but it is not what you could make at a private law firm.
Yeah.
It's not what you could make after being a 2 or 3 term senator from Kentucky. So there's a lot of reasons that he may not be considering that, but still, good move to include him. Good move for him to be included. No question.
But here's a good rule of thumb. You know your future is bright when people might be advising you to reject a federal court of appeals appointment.
With Mitch McConnell in your corner, all things are possible.
Let's take a moment and thank our sponsor, ExpressVPN. Have you ever wondered why internet access is so much cheaper these days, like $30 to $40 a month? It's because internet service providers like Comcast or AT&T aren't just making money off subscription fees. They're also making money from spying on your internet activity and selling your history and data to big tech companies. So what's the best way to make sure that 100% of your data is encrypted and that your internet provider can't get a hold of it? You guessed it, ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN creates a secure tunnel between all your devices and the internet so that everything you do online is encrypted. It reroutes your connection through a secure server. This blocks your internet provider from seeing everything you do online. All they can see is you're connected to an ExpressVPN server, but nothing beyond that. And it's not just for your phone or computer. ExpressVPN works on all your devices. It works on your tablets, smart TVs, even your router, so your entire family can always stay protected. I can't stress this enough. ExpressVPN is so simple to use. You just open up the app, tap one button to connect, and that's it. Your data is your business. Protect it at expressvpn.com/opinions. Visit expressvpn.com/opinions to get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN protection for free. That's expressvpn.com/opinions to learn more. Shall we move on to one of the most contentious topics of anything I've written about at the Dispatch and in our culture at large?
Which for a lot of people wouldn't say much. Like for me, I don't write about a lot of contentious things. I mean, maybe there's some people out there with strong feelings about yard signs, but when David says it's one of the most contentious things he's written about, like that's on a whole different chart than what I even have. That is turning the amp up to 11.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. But sometimes, Sarah, I feel like I could write that the original Star Wars was a good movie and like get death threats. It's weird out there sometimes, but no. Okay. So I wrote a Sunday newsletter in part because I was just getting a flood of questions about critical race theory and what should we think about critical race theory. And let me back up a little bit. I first became acquainted with critical race theory in the fall of 1991. And the reason is that every one of my 1L professors except for one was known as a crit. That was the term we used at the law school to describe a person who is a critical race theory scholar. And to be clear, there's other kinds of critical theory, critical gender, critical race. And I very quickly learned sort of what it was as a general matter, and then the almost impossible complexity of what it is in a particular sense. And so what is it in a general matter? I quoted, I have a definition in my piece, and I'm not going to read the whole definition because it's a little bit opaque in some ways, which is a problem with critical race theory in general. It often has its own lingo. It can be extremely complex, extremely opaque to someone who's not steeped in the lingo of it. But it says, critical race theory recognizes that racism is ingrained in the fabric and system of the American society. The individual racist need not exist to note that institutional racism is pervasive in the dominant culture. This is the analytical lens that critical race theory uses in examining existing power structures. Critical race theory identifies that these power structures are based on white privilege and white supremacy, which perpetuates the marginalization of people of color. Okay, what does that mean in plain English? Well, in plain English,
can I actually add one more sentence to that?
Yeah.
Because I think it's really relevant to the conversation, which is that it also rejects meritocracy and the idea, the concept that everyone who works hard can attain wealth, power, privilege, because the crits at one point, and I think it was literally 1991, like take over the Harvard Law School.
Yes.
And that's always an interesting part of this story to me, is the rejection of meritocracy, which is sort of the pull yourself up by the bootstraps American dream from the 1950s Truman Show-esque conception of America qua America.
You know, Duncan Kennedy at the law school so thoroughly rejected meritocracy that he actually proposed rotating jobs so that a professor would be a professor one semester, a janitor the next semester, and the janitor would be the professor the next semester. And then, so it was like a total leveling. Now, what it also means is that, so if I'm a crit, to use the term we used in the early 90s, what I'm doing is I'm beginning with a starting presumption that there are hidden, or sometimes not so hidden, issues of power and privilege, and also hidden assumptions about the way we communicate through language in almost any circumstance. And so that you can take almost any kind of complex social problem, and you can find, the crit would say, you can find how racism has influenced the way in which our culture has responded to that social issue, or the way in which our culture has defined our business practices or our economic system or whatever. If you peel back the layers far enough, you'll find the white supremacy. You'll find the legacy, at the very least, of racism. And I remember when I was first exposed to it, I sort of had two thoughts at once. One was, there is some low-hanging fruit that I was exposed to that helped me see that there was some real value in questioning things that we just sort of say, this is the way things are because this is the way things are, to say, wait a minute, there's a history here that is actually rooted in an awful lot of explicit racism, even if everyone participating in the system now is not racist, is still influencing the system. And I use this example in my piece of when I was advising a school board, and the school was given the option of a free police officer, a free sheriff's deputy, to be in the school and to be security. This was offered after one of the terrible, terrible school shootings. And initially the board was like, yeah, free security, let's do it. But then the headmaster said, wait a minute. I mean, the chances of a school shooting here are incredibly, incredibly low. But every time what law enforcement does, it has the potential to criminalize school discipline. So for an example, a fight isn't just a fight where the parents come in and the headmaster talks to them and the student's suspended for 3 days and you deal with it. Sometimes the fight's an assault and the person is then processed through the criminal justice system. Or if someone brings some weed to school and maybe sells part of his stash to his classmate, again, the headmaster would call in the parents and they would discipline with counseling perhaps or suspensions, etc. But if you have a law enforcement officer there, then it's a drug deal and somebody is then processed through the criminal justice system. And so he said, you know, do we want to potentially criminalize our system of school justice? And the board thought, no, we don't want to do that, and rejected the cop. Now, for that school, that was the right decision. There, I believe that was the right decision in that decision-making process. There was no discussion of race. There was no hint, like nobody that I know in that room had a racist bone in their body. But the crit looks at that and says, oh, do you see how disparate power, which is rooted in a lot of history, this is a Southern community with a long history, including a history of a race riot in the lifetime of some of the people on the board, created, there's a wealth gap. People in the private school had more wealth. That wealth gap exists because of, in not entirely, but in many ways, because of this system of past racial oppression. That wealth gap creates privilege. So the students in that school had the privilege of committing low-level crimes without fear of criminal enforcement. And then it creates also language and communication issues, because if one place has no police presence at all and another place absolutely has a police presence at all, do we really actually know how much more dangerous one school is than the other? Do we really know these things? And do we then make a lot of assumptions about one school over the other, in part because of these legacies? And that's when I was saying, that's useful. Like, that's useful to help understand why the life you lived, which just feels like total normal life to you, can be rooted in some past things. And again, a lot of people, when you talk about this thing, say, are you saying I'm racist? No, not at all. I'm saying that our existence is rooted in things that occurred often centuries before we were alive, or persisted for centuries, that have massive influence on the way we live now. And that's what, and I'm going to stop monologuing in a second. That was the thing that was useful to me about critical race theory. Then I'll get to the stuff that I don't think is useful. So,
yeah. So I think to the extent we can even call it critical race theory, look, having empathy for other people is a good thing. And if you need a framework in which to build empathy for people who are not you, okay, I'm fine with that. I would argue that there's ways to do it without a framework. You can just try harder. But the part in critical race theory that is different than just building empathy is that it's basically founded in just a few buckets: race, gender, and sexual orientation.
Right.
And I don't want to make light of this, but I have generally found that most people have gone through some hardship in their life. Now, that hardship may be enormous. Like, one, you know, their hardship may be enormous compared to my hardship. But we're all on sort of this hedonic treadmill of hardship, if you will. And so the hardest thing in my life is still a 10, and the hardest thing in their life was still a 10. Their, you know, their 10 may on some grand scale be 1,000 compared to mine, if there were some all experiencing person who got to experience both. But generally speaking, most people have been through a hardship. You have not walked in their shoes. You don't know how hard it was on them. And so having some empathy without even knowing what that hardship was, because maybe it's not based on race or gender or sexual orientation. Maybe it's a sexual assault. Maybe it's, they were orphaned at a young age. Maybe it's a double mastectomy when they were, in high school. whatever that is, it was hard for them and it affected their life in a way that you don't fully understand because you did not have that hardship.
Yeah.
That's a good thing for people to internalize that sense. The problem with critical race theory is that it is used as a cudgel often of, I understand that person's hardship, which is odd because sort of by definition, you don't. And two, that if your hardship does not fall into one of those three buckets, that it shouldn't really count because it's not part of the power structure issue.
And, if it doesn't fall into one of those buckets, it automatically puts you in a place of privilege.
Correct. So the child whose both parents died, they end up homeless, or they were in an abusive family, or something like that, is a white heterosexual male, they are seen in a position of privilege. Now, look, I actually do understand that there are some privileges that come with that, despite being homeless and, you know, abusive parents or whatever else it may be. But to not recognize the, you know, wild disparity just because he happens to be white and male and heterosexual, because it doesn't fall into one of the crit buckets, that they would argue that there's these power structure differences that need to be grappled with. It's too narrow a lens, the crit theory is. And what it does, instead of building empathy for people, which you would think would pull people together, what crit theory does is it pulls people apart.
Well, it's very, you know, so the couple of things that about it that, so I agree with everything that you just said by putting such a premium on the racial experience. It does absolutely divide. It focuses on race to an extreme degree. And in focusing on race to extreme degree, what it often does is it begins with a starting presumption that virtually anything that you see, any phenomenon, whether it's big like capitalism or whether it's smaller like minimum wage laws, to you name it, almost anything can and must be analyzed, if not exclusively, then often primarily through a racial lens. And so this is how you get to some of the really convoluted scholarship, where you'll find people peeling and peeling and peeling and peeling through writings and speeches and writings and speeches. And then they'll find find something that was racially problematic and say, aha, you know, this is why this structure, and this reinforces our idea that this structure is based on race. And one of the areas where you saw this, I think, was most notably was like the 1619 Project, which had a number of portions of it that were actually, you know, quite useful and worth reading and very, very interesting and fascinating on their own terms. But then when it began to say that, you know, the 1619 was the true American founding, when it began to argue that the American Revolution was based in large part on the idea of the desire to preserve slavery, you know, then you begin to see this influence, this distorting influence of a crit lens on the past. Like, I'm totally about saying, okay, I am very open to trying to understand if I have privilege that I did not experience, because you often don't experience your life as privileged. It's just your life, right? I'm totally open to understanding and to learning about concepts of privilege and to hearing an argument about that. But then to then say, the analytical lens that we should use is one that is going to take essentially every part of every American power structure and shoehorn a white privilege, white supremacy analysis into it, it starts to fall apart and it starts to get almost impossibly complicated as you're trying to find and unpack and deconstruct. And somehow, in some ways, this is one of the reasons why the language, excuse me, gets so opaque and why the analysis often gets so difficult to follow, because it's starting with the starting presumption and then trying to unwind everything to find the proof to prove the starting presumption. And I find it often not just very unhelpful, but often ahistorical. And the other thing that I would say is this very explicit rejection of liberalism, small L liberalism, is very dangerous and also, again, ahistorical for determining how, for example, many marginalized communities have attained a greater degree of equality. They've attained it not by rejecting liberalism, but by appealing to the promise of liberalism and highlighting its absence in their experience. And so, you know, time and time again, going back to Frederick Douglass, I mean, Frederick Douglass absolutely respected free speech as a value, one of the fundamental underlying virtues of liberalism, and noted how its absence was contributing to oppression. And so the rejection of liberalism, of critical race theory, to me is one of its core flaws, because it's liberalism itself that has begun to liberate our country from that legacy of 1619.
I also, so there was a story on Thursday, I guess it came out, Washington Post. I think we'll include it in the show notes because it's a meaningful read. It's not that long. And the headline was "A Pandemic, A Motel Without Power, and a Potentially Terrifying Glimpse of Orlando's Future." And it is the story of a handful of people, you know, our fellow Americans living in a hotel, motel, where the owner abandoned it outside Orlando. The power has been shut off. They have nowhere else to go. They're sort of living on the edge of society as it was before the pandemic hit. And now they're stuck. And there's, you know, an 82-year-old man there, a 17-year-old girl. And what I guess struck me in reading it in this, the context of this conversation, is their race, gender, and sexuality does not matter in the next hour in a 95-degree day without power. Right. And without money. They are experiencing something together that we should not really accept in this country, I would argue. But crit theory has very little to say to these people.
Mm-hmm.
And what it has tried to do, and maybe there was a reason to do this, was to build bridges between people who maybe did not think they shared a lot in common, but do share a race or a sexual orientation, a gender identity, whatever. But oftentimes, experience trumps those things. And again, empathy, I am very in favor of. But what crit theory has done is it would look at this story and divide these people further.
Yeah.
At a time when they need this very fragile community that they do have to survive. And when, it doesn't matter what race they are. The 17-year-old and the 82-year-old have been put into a terrible situation. And, you know, she loses her job at Taco Bell. And now she can't go back because she can't get a coronavirus test because it's 11 miles away and she doesn't have a car and the bus doesn't go there. You know, those are the stories that I'm interested in someone's academic theory for how we talk about those things. I am less interested in academic theory that came about in the early 90s that I think has largely outlived a lot of its usefulness, and it's time for a new way to talk about empathy, privilege, if you want to use that term. I think that term's become quite loaded. I think it really is another way to talk about empathy.
I think that's right. I also would say that one of the reasons why critical theory is alluring is that it is in touch with the illiberalism and authoritarianism of our time. So it is a very much of a will to power sort of worldview, because if you're going to reject liberalism, if you're rejecting sort of these neutral rules, like free speech is a neutral value that we can ideally should all be able to take advantage of, or due process, for example, on college campuses, where, over time, the rejection of liberalism has meant that rejections of due process in some circumstances. If you're rejecting these things, what are you replacing them with? And what you're often replacing them with is a kind of authoritarianism that is built around this concept of experiential authority. that sort of says, okay, there's going to be a group of people, mainly often young activists, who say, I am going to stand in and speak for the Black male experience. And, or I'm going to stand in and I'm going to speak to the lesbian experience. And, it's often very flattening, very leveling, and there's one experience. It doesn't account for the diversity within these groups. And then you fashion speech rules, you fashion due process rules, you fashion school policies, all based on the unquestionable experiential authority of a particular subset of a particular demographic. And it elevates people, it gives people a lot of power if you're in that group. It gives you a ton of power. And it's often a power wrapped in a kind of virtue that I am the one who's ameliorating all of these centuries of injustice. And so it's a very alluring ideology if you've got in towards that sort of will to power authoritarianism or illiberalism that's sweeping across the land. And there's an illiberalism on the right that we could talk about a ton, but this is something that is an illiberalism on the left. And it was the impetus for the college speech code, which I fought and fought and fought and fought for years and years. But what they intentionally tried to do with the college speech code was say, free speech has been the enemy. We're going to redress the balance of power by putting other people in charge of speech according to their subjectively defined rules. And it did not achieve the results that people wanted it to achieve.
I think that's just a great point about power. Because first of all, not everyone, people who seek power will justify their power-seeking desires and authorities. And that is the history of humanity, probably more than anything else, is power-seeking among a certain segment of humans and how what they do to justify that power and then how they use that power.
Yeah. So, I mean, my bottom line is pretty simple. I'm grateful to the professors I had in the early 90s who helped me understand, question some of the assumptions about why things were the way they were. But what they actually ended up doing is reinforcing my commitment to liberalism, to show to me which communities of Americans needed further extension of the blessings of liberty and further protections of the Constitution. Not that we toss the blessings of liberty and toss the Constitution to turn American power dynamics upside down. It's an extension, not a reversal. And I think those are different concepts. Anything else, Sarah?
No.
Okay. Well, I didn't, I'm a little upset because I didn't get to really plunge into how six or seven members of the Supreme Court list take their coffee, how they like their steaks cooked. But you can't lay it all out for the listeners in every podcast. You got to leave them wanting more, really. So
it's like a whole different type of privilege when you're talking about how many people on the Supreme Court list you've had coffee with.
That is true. If we have any crit listeners, their heads have been exploding over the privilege.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. And as I said at the beginning, please check out our free 30-day trial, thedispatch.com/30daysfree. Also, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts and rate us on Apple Podcasts. It is much appreciated. Until next time, this has been the Advisory Opinions Podcast with David French and Sarah Isker.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.